top of the fourth. Her mother was moving furniture. That was Trisha's first returning thought. Her second thought was that Dad had taken her to Good Skates in Lynn, and what she heard was the sound of kids rollerblading past on the old canted track. Then something cold splashed onto the bridge of her nose, and she opened her eyes. Another cold drop of water splashed down dead center on her forehead. Bright light ran across the sky, making her wince and squint. This was followed by a second crash of thunder that startled her into a sideways roll. She pulled instinctively into a fetal position, uttering a croaky little scream as she did so. Then the skies opened. Trisha sat up, grabbing and replacing her baseball cap when it fell off without even thinking about it, gasping like someone who had been tossed rudely into a cold lake, and that was what it felt like. She staggered to her feet. Thunder boomed again and lightning opened a purple seam in the air. As she stood with rain dripping from the tip of her nose and her hair lying lank against her cheeks, she saw a tall, half-dead spruce on the valley floor before her suddenly explode and fall into two flaming pieces. A moment later, the rain was sheeting down so thickly that the valley was only a sketched ghost wrapped in gray gauze. She backed up, getting into the cover of the woods again. She knelt, opened her pack, and got out the blue poncho. She put it on, better late than never, her father would have said, and sat on a fallen tree. Her head was still woozy and her eyelids were all swollen and itchy. The surrounding woods caught some of the rain, but not all of it. The downpour was too fierce. Trisha flipped up the poncho's hood and listened to the drops tap on it, like rain on the roof of a car. She saw the ever-present cloud of bugs dancing in front of her eyes and waved them away with a strengthless hand. Nothing makes them go away, and they're always hungry. They fed on my eyelids when I was passed out, and they'll feed on my dead body, she thought, and began to cry again. This time it was low and dispirited. As she wept, she continued waving at the bugs, cringing each time the thunder roared overhead. With no watch and no sun, there was no time. All Trisha knew was that she sat there, a small figure in a blue poncho, huddled on a fallen tree, until the thunder began to fade eastward, sounding to her like a vanquished but still truculent bully. Rain dripped down on her. Mosquitoes hummed. One caught between the inside wall of her poncho's hood and the side of her head. She jabbed a thumb against the outside of the hood, and the hum abruptly stopped.
There, she said disconsolately. That takes care of you. You're jam.
She started to get up, and her stomach rumbled. She hadn't been hungry before, but she was now. The thought that she had been lost long enough to get hungry was awful in its own way. She wondered how many more awful things were waiting, and was glad she didn't know, couldn't see.
Maybe none, she told herself. Hey, girl, get happy. Maybe all the awful things are behind you now.
Trisha took off her poncho. Before opening her pack, she looked ruefully down at herself. She was wet from head to toe and covered with pine needles from her faint, her very first fainting spell. She would have to tell Pepsi, always assuming she ever saw Pepsi again.
Don't start that, she said, and unbuckled the pack's flap.
She took out the stuff she had brought to eat and drink, laying the items out before her in a neat line. At the sight of the paper sack with her lunch in it, her stomach rumbled more fiercely. How late was it? Some deep mental clock attached to her metabolism suggested it might be around 3 p.m. 8 hours since she'd sat in the breakfast nook, slurping up cornflakes. 5 since she'd started off in this endless, idiotic shortcut. 3 o'clock. Maybe even 4. In her lunch sack was a hard-boiled egg still in the shell, a tuna fish sandwich, and some celery sticks. There was also the bag of chips, small, the bottle of water, pretty big, the bottle of Surge, the large 20-ounce size, she loved Surge, and the Twinkies. Looking at the bottle of lemon-lime soda, Trisha suddenly felt more thirsty than hungry and mad for sugar. She spun off the cap, brought the bottle to her lips, then paused. It wouldn't be smart to go chugging half of it down, she thought, thirsty or not. She might be out here a while. Part of her mind moaned and tried to draw away from that idea, just call it ridiculous and draw away, but Trisha couldn't afford to let it. She could think like a kid again once she was out of the woods,
but for the time being, she had to think as much like an adult as possible. You saw what's out there, she thought. A big valley with nothing in it except trees. No roads, no smoke. You have to play it smart. You have to conserve your supplies. Mom would tell you the same thing, and so would Dad. She allowed herself 3 big gulps of soda, took the bottle away from her mouth, belched, took another 2 fast swallows. She then recapped the bottle securely and debated over the rest of her supplies. She decided on the egg. She shelled it, careful to put the pieces of shell back in the baggie the egg had come in. It never occurred to her then or later that littering any sign that she'd been there might actually save her life, and sprinkled it with a little twist of salt. Doing that made her sob briefly again, because she could see herself in the Sanford kitchen last night, putting salt on a scrap of waxed paper and then twisting it up the way her mother had shown her. She could see the shadows of her head and hands, thrown by the overhead light on the Formica counter. She could hear the sound of the TV news from the living room, could hear the creaks as her brother moved around upstairs. This memory had an hallucinogenic clarity that elevated it almost to the status of a vision. She felt like someone who drowns remembering what it was like to still be on the boat, so calm and at ease, so carelessly safe. She was 9, though 9 going on 10 and big for her age. Hunger was stronger than either memory or fear. She sprinkled the egg with salt and ate it quickly, still sniffling. It was delicious. She could have eaten another easily, maybe 2. Mom called eggs cholesterol bombs, but her mom wasn't here, and cholesterol didn't seem like a very big deal when you were lost in the woods, scratched up and with your eyelids so swollen by bug bites that they felt weighted down with something. Flour paste stuck to the lashes, perhaps. Tricia eyed the Twinkies, then opened the package and ate one of them. Sexual, she said, one of Pepsi's all-time great compliments. She chased everything with a gulp of water. Then, moving quickly before either hand could turn traitor and stuff something else into her mouth, she put the remaining food back in the lunch sack. The top rolled down quite a bit further now, rechecked the seal on her 3/4 full bottle of Surge, and stowed everything in the pack. As she did, her fingers brushed a bulge in the pack's sidewall in a sudden burst of elation, perhaps partially fueled by fresh calories, lit her up. Her Walkman! She had brought her Walkman! Yeah, baby! She unzipped the inner pocket and lifted it out as reverently as any priest has ever handled the Eucharist. The headphone wire was wrapped around the body of the Walkman, and the tiny earbuds were clipped neatly to the sides of its black plastic body. Her and Pepsi's current favorite tape, Tub Thumper by Chumbawamba, was in there, but Tricia didn't care about music just then. She slipped the headphones on, nestled the earbuds into place, flipped the switch from tape to radio, and turned it on. At first, there was nothing but a soft rush of static because she had been tuned to WMGX, a Portland station. But a little further down the FM band, she came to WOXO in Norway. And when she tuned up the other way, she got WCAS, the little station in Castle Rock, a town they had passed through on their way to the Appalachian Trail. She could almost hear her brother, his voice dripping with that newly discovered teenage sarcasm of his, saying something like, WCAS, Hicksville today, tomorrow the world. And it was a Hicksville station, no doubt about that. Whiny cowboy singers like Mark Chestnut and Trace Adkins alternated with a female announcer who took calls from people who wanted to sell washers, dryers, Buicks, and hunting rifles. Still, it was human contact, voices in the wilderness, and Tricia sat on the fallen tree transfixed, waving absently at the constant cloud of bugs with her cap. The first time check she heard was 3:09. At 3:30, the female announcer put the community trading post on hold long enough to read the local news. Folks in Castle Rock were up in arms about a bar where there were now topless dancers on Friday and Saturday nights. There had been a fire at a local nursing home, no one hurt, and Castle Rock Speedway was supposed to reopen on the 4th of July with brand new stands and loads of fireworks. Rainy this afternoon, clearing tonight, sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid-80s. That was it. No missing little girl. Tricia didn't know whether to be relieved or worried. She reached to turn off the power and save the batteries, then paused as the female announcer added,
"Don't forget that the Boston Red Sox take on those pesky New York Yankees tonight at 7 o'clock. You can catch all the action right here on WCAS, where we've got our socks on. And now back to..."
Now back to the shittiest day a little girl ever had, Tricia thought, turning off the radio and wrapping the cord around the slim plastic body again. Yet the truth was that she felt almost all right for the first time since that nasty minnow had started swimming around in her midsection. Having something to eat was partially the reason, but she suspected that the radio had more to do with it. Voices. Real human voices, and sounding so close. There was a cluster of mosquitoes on each of her thighs, trying to drill through the material of her jeans. Thank God she hadn't worn shorts. She would have been chuck steak by now. She swatted the mosquitoes away, then got up. What now? Did she know anything at all about being lost in the woods? Well, that the sun rose in the east and went down in the west, that was about all. Once someone had told her that moss grew on the north or south side of a tree, but she couldn't remember which. Maybe the best thing would be to just sit here. Try to make some sort of shelter. More against the bugs than the rain, there were mosquitoes inside the hood of her poncho again. They were driving her crazy. And wait for someone to come. If she had matches, maybe she could make a fire. The rain would keep it from spreading, and someone would see the smoke. Of course, if pigs had wings, bacon would fly. Her father said that. Wait a minute, she said. Wait a minute. Something about water. Finding your way out of the woods by water. Now what? It came to her, and she felt another burst of elation. This one was so strong that it made her feel almost giddy. She actually swayed a little bit on her feet as one would at the sound of catchy music. You found a stream. Her mother hadn't told her that. She had read it in one of the little house books a long time ago. Maybe way back when she'd been 7. You found a stream and followed it, and sooner or later it would either lead you out or to a bigger stream. If it was a bigger stream, you followed it until it led you out or to a bigger stream yet. But in the end, running water had to lead you out because it always ran to the sea. And there were no woods there, only the beach and rocks and the occasional lighthouse. And how would she find running water? Why, she would follow the bluff, of course, the one that she had almost run off the edge of, stupid Nick that she was. The bluff would lead her in one steady direction, and sooner or later she'd find a brook. The woods were full of them, as the saying went. She reshouldered her pack, this time putting it on over the poncho, and walked carefully toward the bluff and the fallen ash tree. She now looked back on her panicky plunge through the woods with the mixture of indulgence and embarrassment adults feel when looking back upon the worst of their childhood behavior, but she found she could still not go very close to the edge. It would make her feel sick if she did. She might faint again. Or vomit. Vomiting up any of her food when she had so little would be a very bad idea. She turned to the left and began walking through the woods with a drop-off to the valley about 20 feet to her right. Every now and then she would force herself to go closer to make sure she wasn't drifting away, that the bluff with its wide view was still there. She listened for voices, but not very hopefully. The trail might be anywhere now, and to stumble on it would be pure dumb luck. What she was listening for was running water, and at last she heard it. Won't do me any good if it goes over that stupid cliff in a waterfall, she thought, and decided she had to get close enough to the edge to check out the drop before she reached the stream, if only to guard against disappointment. The trees had drawn back a little here, and the space between the edge of the forest and the edge of the drop was dotted with bushes. They would, 4 or 5 weeks later, bear a lush crop of blueberries. Now, however, the berries were just tiny buds, green and inedible. Still, there had been checkerberries. They were in season, and it might be a good idea to keep that in mind, just in case. The ground between the blueberry bushes was scaly and shifty with busted rock. The sound under Tricia's sneakers made her think of broken plates. She walked ever more slowly over this scree, and when she was 10 feet or so from the edge of the drop, she got down and crawled. I'm safe. Perfectly safe because I know it's there. Nothing to worry about. But her heart was still hammering in her chest, and when she got to the edge, she uttered a bewildered little laugh because the drop was hardly there at all anymore. The view across the valley was still wide and sweeping, but wouldn't be for much longer because the terrain on this side had been sinking. Tricia had been listening so hard and thinking so hard, mostly reminding herself to keep her head, not to go bazonka again, that she hadn't even realized. She worked her way further, pushing through a final little screen of bushes, and looked down. The drop was now only about 20 feet and no longer sheer. The rock face had become a steep, rubbly slope. Down below were scrubby trees, more fruitless blueberry bushes, tangles of brambles, and scattered everywhere were heaps of broken-up glacial rock. The downpour had stopped, the thunder had retreated to the occasional ill-natured mutter, but it had continued to drizzle and these heaps of rock had a slick, unpleasant look, like slag from a mine. Tricia backed up and got to her feet, then continued to make her way through the bushes toward the sound of running water. She was starting to feel tired now, her legs aching, but she thought she was basically okay. Afraid, of course, but not so badly as before. They would find her. When people got lost in the woods, they always found them. They sent out planes and helicopters and guys with bloodhounds, and they hunted until the lost person was found. Or maybe I'll kind of save myself. Find a camp in the woods somewhere. Break a window if the door's locked and there's no one home. Use the telephone. Tricia could see herself in some hunter's cabin which hadn't been used since the previous fall. She could see camp furniture, covered with faded paisley drop cloths, and a bearskin rug on the board floor. She could smell dust and old stove ashes. This daydream was so clear, she could even smell a trace of ancient coffee. The place was empty, but the telephone worked. It was one of the old-fashioned ones, the handset so heavy that she had to hold it in both hands. But it worked, and she could hear herself saying, "Hello, Mom? This is Tricia. I don't know exactly where I am, but I'm all right." She was so absorbed in the imaginary cabin and the imaginary phone call that she came close to falling into a small stream that had emerged from the woods and cascaded down the rubble-strewn slope. Tricia grabbed at the branches of an alder and stood looking at the stream, actually smiling a little. It had been a crappy day, all right. Trey crappy. But her luck finally seemed to be turning, and that was a big hooray. She walked to the edge of the slope. The stream spilled down it in a foamy rush, here and there striking a bigger rock and kicking up spray that would have held rainbows on a sunny afternoon. The slope on both sides of the water looked slippery and unreliable. All that loose, wet rock. Still, it was also dotted with bushes. If she started to slide, she would grab one of those as she'd grabbed the alder at the edge of the stream. "Water leads to people," she said, and started down the slope. She descended sideways, in little hops, on the right side of the stream. At first she was all right, even though the angle of the slope was steeper than it had looked from up above, and the broken ground shifted under her sneakers every time she moved. Her pack, of which she had hardly been aware of up until now, began to feel like a large, unstable baby in one of those papoose carriers. Every time it shifted, she had to wave her arms to keep her balance. She was all right, though, and a darn good thing, because when she paused halfway down the slope, her propping right foot actually buried in loose rock below her. She realized she couldn't climb back up anymore. One way or the other, she was bound for the valley floor. She got moving again. Three-quarters of the way down, a bug, a big one, not a minge or a mosquito, flew into her face. It was a wasp, and Tricia batted at it with a cry. Her pack shifted violently to her downhill side, her right foot slipped, and suddenly her balance was gone. She fell, hit the rock slope on her shoulder with a tooth-rattling thud, and began to slide. "Oh, shit on toast!" she cried, and grabbed at the ground. All she got was a strew of loose rock that slid along with her and a sharp jab of pain as a broken chunk of quartz cut her palm. She snatched at a bush and it came out by its stupid shallow roots. Her foot struck something, her right leg bent at a painful angle, and she was suddenly airborne, the world revolving as she did an unplanned somersault. Tricia came down on her back and slid that way, legs spread, arms waving, screaming in pain and terror and surprise. Her poncho and the back of her shirt pulled up to her shoulder blades, sharp pieces of rock tore snatches of skin from between them. She tried to break with her feet. The left one struck a jutting outcrop of shale and turned her to the right. That put her into a roll, first on her stomach, and then onto her back, and then onto her stomach again, the pack digging into her, then pitching upward each time she went over. The sky was down, the hateful broken scree of the slope was up, and they swapped places. Swing your partner with a do-si-do, everybody change. Trisha went the final 10 yards on her left side, with her left arm stretched out and her face buried against the fold of her elbow. She thumped against something hard enough to bruise her ribs on that side. And then, before she could even look up from her arm, a needle of pain drove into her just above her left cheekbone. Trisha shrieked and jerked to her knees, slapping. She crushed something. Another wasp, of course, what else? Even as it stung her again, even as she opened her eyes and saw them all around her. Yellow, brown insects that looked weighted down in the tail section. Plump, ungainly, poison factories. She had slid into a dead tree, standing at the foot of the slope about 25 feet from the brawling streamlet. In the dead tree's lowest fork, just at eye level to a little girl who was 9 but tall for her age, was a gray paper nest. Agitated wasps were crawling all over it. More were flying out of the hole in the top. Pain needled the right side of Trisha's neck, just below the bill of her cap. Another sting lit up her right arm above the elbow. Screaming in a total panic, she bolted. Something stung the back of her neck. Something stung the small of her back, above the waistband of her blue jeans, where her shirt was still pulled up and the plastic poncho hung in tatters. She ran in the direction of the stream without any thought or plan or intent. It was just that the ground there was relatively open. She wove her way around the clumps of bushes, and when the underbrush began to thicken, she bowled through it. At the stream, she stopped, gasping for breath, looking tearfully and fearfully back over her shoulder. The wasps were gone, but they had done plenty of damage before she had managed to outrun them. Her left eye, close to where the first one had gotten her, was swelled almost shut. "If I get a bad reaction, I'll die," she thought. But in the aftermath of her panic, she didn't care. She sat down by the little stream which had gotten her into all this trouble, sobbing and sniffling. When she felt a little bit in control of herself again, she took off her pack. Tight, fierce shudders racked her, each one making her body harden up like a spring and pulling red-hot darts of pain from the places where she had been stung. She put her arms around her pack, rocked it like a doll, and cried harder. Holding the pack that way made her think of Mona lying in the back seat of the caravan. Good old Moni Baloney with her big blue eyes. There had been times, while her parents were getting ready to divorce, and then actually doing it, when Mona had felt like her only comfort. There were times when not even Pepsi could understand. Now her parents' divorce seemed like very small beans. There were bigger problems than grown-ups who couldn't get along. There were wasps, for one thing, and Trisha thought she would give anything to see Mona again. At least she wasn't going to die from the stings, or she'd probably be dying already. She had overheard her mom and Mrs. Thomas from across the street talking about someone who was allergic to stings, and Mrs. Thomas had said, 10 seconds after it gum him, poor old Frank was swelled up like a balloon. If he hadn't had his little kit with the hypodermic, I guess he would have choked to death. Trisha didn't feel choky, but the bites throbbed horribly, and they had swelled up like balloons, all right. The one by her eye had built a hot little volcano of tissue that she could actually look at, and when she probed gingerly with her fingers, a bolt of pain shot into her head and made her cry out in misery. She was no longer exactly weeping, but that eye ran helplessly with tears just the same. Moving her hands slowly and carefully, Trisha examined herself. She isolated at least half a dozen stings. She thought there was one location on her left side just above the hip where she might have sustained 2 or even 3. It was the sorest place of all. Her back felt all scraped up, and her left arm, which had absorbed most of the damage during the final part of her slide, was a net of blood from wrist to elbow. The side of her face where the stump of the branch had poked her was bleeding again, too. "Not fair," she thought. "Not fair." Then a terrible idea occurred to her. Except it was more than an idea, it was a certainty. Her Walkman was broken, shattered to a million pieces in its little side pocket. Had to be. There was no way it could have survived the slide. Tricia tugged the pack's buckles with blood-streaked, trembling fingers and at last worked the straps free. She pulled out her Game Boy, and that was smashed all right. Nothing left of the window where the little electronic blips had gambolled but a few shards of yellow glass. Also, her bag of potato chips had burst open, and the Game Boy's cracked white housing was covered with greasy crumbs. Both plastic bottles, the one with the water in it and the bottle of Surge, were dented, but whole. Her lunch sack was smushed into something that looked like roadkill and covered with more potato chips, but Tricia didn't even bother looking inside. "My Walkman," she thought, unaware that she was sobbing as she unzipped the inner pocket. "My poor, poor Walkman." To be separated from even the voices of the human world seemed more than she could bear on top of everything else. Tricia reached into the pocket and pulled out a miracle. The Walkman intact. The earphone cord, which she had rewrapped neatly around the little gadget's body, had come loose in a tangle, but that was all. She held the Walkman in her hand, looking incredulously from it to the Game Boy lying beside her. How could one be whole and the other so badly shattered? How was that possible? "It's not," the cold and hateful voice in her head informed her. "It looks all right, but it's broken inside." Tricia straightened the cord, slipped the earbuds into place, and settled her finger on the power button. She had forgotten the stings, the insect bites, the cuts, and the scrapes. She closed her swollen, heavy eyelids, making a little dark. "Please, God," she said into it, "don't let my Walkman be broken." Then she pushed the power button.
"This just in,"
said the female announcer. She might have been broadcasting from the middle of Trish's head.
"A Sanford woman hiking a Castle County section of the Appalachian Trail with her two children has reported her daughter, 9-year-old Patricia McFarland, missing and presumably lost in the woods west of TR-90 and the town of Maunton."
Trisha's eyes flew wide open, and she listened for the next 10 minutes, long after WCAS had reverted, like someone with unbreakable bad habits, to country music and NASCAR reports. She was lost in the woods. It was official. Soon they would swing into action, whoever they were, the people she supposed who kept the helicopters ready to fly and the bloodhounds ready to sniff. Her mother would be scared to death, and yet Tricia felt a small, strange trickle of satisfaction when she considered that likelihood. "I wasn't supervised," she thought, not without self-righteousness. "I'm just a little kid, and I wasn't properly supervised. Also, if she gives me hell, I'll just say, 'You wouldn't stop arguing, and finally I couldn't stand it anymore.'" Pepsi would like that. It was just so V.C. Andrews. At last, she turned the Walkman off, rewrapped the headphone wire, gave the black plastic case a perfectly unselfconscious smooch, and tucked it lovingly back into its pocket. She eyed the mashed-up lunch bag and decided she couldn't bring herself to look inside and see what shape the tuna sandwich and the remaining Twinkie might be in. Too depressing. A good thing she'd eaten her egg before, it could turn into egg salad. That thought probably deserved a giggle, but there were apparently no giggles in her. The old giggle well, which her mother believed inexhaustible, seemed to have temporarily gone dry. Tricia sat on the bank of the little stream, which was less than 3 feet across here, and disconsolately ate potato chips, first out of the burst chip bag, and then plucking them off her lunch sack and finally dredging the smallest fragments out of the bottom of her pack. A big bug droned past her nose, and she cringed from it, crying out and raising a hand to protect her face, but it was only a horsefly. At last, moving as wearily as a woman of 60 after a hard day's work, she felt like a woman of 60 after a hard day's work, Tricia replaced everything in her pack, even the shattered Game Boy went back in, and stood up. Before rebuckling the flap, she took off her poncho and held it up in front of her. The flimsy thing hadn't been any protection in her slide down the slope, and now it was torn and flapping in a way she would have considered comic under other circumstances. It looked almost like a blue plastic hula skirt. But she supposed she'd better keep it. If nothing else, it might protect her from the bugs, which had reformed their cloud around her hapless head. The mosquitoes were thicker than ever, no doubt drawn by the blood on her arms. They probably smelled it. "Yug," Tricia said, wrinkling her nose and waving her cap at the cloud of bugs. "How gross is that?" She tried to tell herself she ought to be grateful. She hadn't broken her arm or fractured her skull, also grateful that she wasn't allergic to stings like Mrs. Thomas's friend Frank. But it was hard to be grateful when you were so scared, scratched, swollen, and generally banged up. She was putting rags of her poncho back on, the pack would come next, when she looked at the stream and noticed how muddy the banks were just above the water. She dropped to one knee, wincing as the waist of her jeans chafed against the wasp stings above her hip, and took a fingerful of pasty brown gray gluck. Try it or not. Well, what can it hurt? She asked with a little sigh, and dabbed the mud on the swelling above her hip. It was blessedly cool, and the itchy pain diminished almost at once. Working carefully, she dabbed mud on as many of the stings as she could reach, including the one which had puffed up beside her eye. Then she wiped her hands on her jeans, both hands and jeans considerably more battered now than they had been 6 hours ago, donned her torn poncho, then shrugged into her pack. Luckily, it lay without rubbing against any of the places where she'd been stung. Tricia began walking beside the stream again, and 5 minutes later, she re-entered the woods. She followed the stream for the next 4 hours or so, hearing nothing but twittering birds and the ceaseless drone of bugs. It drizzled for most of that time, and once it showered hard enough to wet her through again, even though she took shelter under the biggest tree she could find. At least there was no thunder and lightning with the second downpour. Tricia had never felt as much like a town girl as she did while that miserable, terrifying day was winding down toward dark. The woods came in clenches, it seemed to her. For a while she would walk through great old stands of pine, and there the forest seemed almost all right, like the woods in a Disney cartoon. Then one of those clenches would come, and she would find herself struggling through snarly clumps of scrubby trees and thick bushes, all too many of the latter, the kind with thorns, fighting past interlaced branches that clawed for her arms and eyes. Their only purpose seemed to be obstruction, and as mere tiredness slipped toward exhaustion, Tricia began to impute them with actual intelligence, a sly and hurtful awareness of the outsider in the ragged blue poncho. It began to seem to her that their desire to scratch her, to perhaps even get lucky and poke out one of her eyes, was actually secondary. What the bushes really wanted was to shunt her away from the brook, her path to other people, her ticket out. Tricia was willing to leave sight of the brook if the clenches of trees and tangles of bushes near it got too thick, but she refused to leave the sound of it. If the brook's low babble got too thin, she'd drop to her hands and knees and crawl under the worst of the branches rather than sliding along them and looking for a hole. Crawling over this squelchy ground was the worst part. In the pine groves, the ground was dry and nicely carpeted with needles. In the clenchy tangles, it always seemed wet. Her pack dragged through the lacings of branches and bushes, sometimes actually getting stuck. And all the time, no matter how thick the going, the cloud of minges and no-see-ums hung and danced in front of her face. She understood what made all of this so bad, so dispiriting, but could not articulate it. It had something to do with all the things she couldn't name. Some stuff she knew because her mother had told her, the birches, the beeches, the alders, the spruces and pines, the hollow hammering of a woodpecker and the harsh cawing cry of the crows, the creaky door sound of the crickets as the day began to darken. But what was everything else? If her mother had told her, Tricia no longer remembered, but she didn't think her mother had told her in the first place. She thought her mother was really just a town girl from Massachusetts who had lived in Maine for a while, liked to walk in the woods, and had read a few nature guides. What, for instance, were the thick bushes with the shiny green leaves? Please God, not poison oak. Or the small, trashy-looking trees with the dusty gray trunks? Or the ones with the narrow, hanging leaves? The woods around Sanford, the woods her mother knew and walked, sometimes with Tricia and sometimes alone, were toy woods. These were not toy woods. Tricia tried to imagine hundreds of searchers flooding toward her. Her imagination was good, and at first she was able to do this quite easily. She saw big yellow school buses with the words Charter Search Party in the destination windows pulling into parking areas all along the western main part of the Appalachian Trail. The doors opened and out spilled men in brown uniforms, some with dogs on chains, all with walkie-talkies clipped to their belts, a special few with those battery-powered loud hailers. These would be what she heard first, big, amplified God voices calling,
Patricia McFarland! Where are you? If you hear, come to the sound of my voice!
But as the shadows in the woods thickened and joined hands, there was only the sound of the stream, no wider and no smaller than when she had tumbled down the slope beside it, and the sound of her own breathing. Her mental pictures of the men in brown uniforms weakened, little by little. I can't stay out here all night, she thought. No one can expect me to stay out here all night. She felt panic trying to grab her again. It was speeding her heartbeat, drying out her mouth, making her eyes throb in their sockets. She was lost in the woods, hemmed in by trees for which she had no name, alone in a place where her town girl vocabulary had little use, and she was consequently left with just a narrow range of recognition and reaction, all of it primitive, from town girl to cave girl in one easy step. She was afraid of the dark even when she was at home in her room, with the glow from the streetlight on the corner falling in through the window. She thought that if she had to spend the night out here, she would die of terror. Part of her wanted to run. Never mind how flowing water was bound to take her to people eventually. All that was just a crock of Little House on the Prairie shit. She had been following the stream for miles now, and all it had brought her to was more bugs. She wanted to run away from it, run in whatever direction the going was easiest, run and find people before it got dark. That the idea was totally nutso didn't help much. It certainly didn't change the throb in her eyes, and the stung places, now they were throbbing too, or ease the coppery fear taste in her mouth. Tricia fought her way through a tangle of trees growing so close together they were almost intertwined and came out in a little crescent of clearing where the brook took an elbow bend to the left. This crescent, hemmed in on all sides by bushes and raggedy clumps of trees, looked like a little patch of Eden to Tricia. There was even a fallen tree trunk for a bench. She went to it, sat down, closed her eyes, and tried to pray for rescue. Asking God not to let her Walkman be broken had been easy because it had been unthinking. Now, however, praying was hard. Neither of her parents were churchgoers. Her mom was a lapsed Catholic, and her dad, so far as Tricia knew, had never had anything to lapse from. And now she discovered herself lost and without vocabulary in another way. She said the Our Father, and it came out of her mouth sounding flat and uncomforting, about as useful as an electric can opener would have been out here. She opened her eyes and looked around the little clearing, seeing all too well how gray the air was becoming, clasping her scratched hands nervously together. She couldn't remember ever discussing spiritual matters with her mother, but she had asked her father not a month ago if he believed in God. They had been out behind his little place in Malden eating ice cream cones from the Sunny Treat man, who still came by in his tinkling white truck. Thinking of the Sunny Treat truck now made Tricia feel like crying again. Pete had been down the park, as they said in Malden, goofing with his old friends. God, Dad had said, seeming to taste the word like some new ice cream flavor. Vanilla with God instead of vanilla with Jimmy's. What brought that on, sugar? She shook her head, not knowing. Now sitting on the fallen trunk in this cloudy, buggy June dusk, a frightening idea bloomed. What if she had asked because some deep, future-seeing part of her had known that this was going to happen? Had known, had decided she was going to need a little God to get through, and had sent up a flare. God, Larry McFarlane had said, licking his ice cream. God, now God. He thought a while longer. Tricia had sat quietly on her side of the picnic table, looking out at his little yard. It needed mowing, giving him all the time he needed. At last he said, I'll tell you what I believe in. I believe in the sub-audible. The what? She had looked at him, not sure if he was joking or not. He didn't look as if he was joking. The sub-audible. Do you remember when we lived on 4th Street? Of course she remembered the house on 4th Street, three blocks from where they were, near the Lynn town line. A bigger house than this, with a bigger backyard that Dad had always kept mown, back when Sanford was just for grandparents and summer vacations, and Pepsi Robichaux was just her summer friend, and arm farts were the funniest things in the universe. Except, of course, for real farts. On 4th Street, the kitchen didn't smell of stale beer the way this house's kitchen did. She nodded, remembering very well.
It had electric heat, that house. Do you remember how the baseboard units would hum even when they weren't heating? Even in the summer? Trisha had shaken her head, and her father had nodded his, as if that was what he expected. That's because you got used to it, he said. But take my word, Trish, that sound was always there. Even in a house where there aren't baseboard heaters, there are noises. The fridge goes on and off, the pipes thunk, the floors creak, the traffic goes by outside. We hear those things all the time. So most of the time, we don't hear them at all. They become... And he gestured for her to finish, as he had done since she was very small, sitting on his lap and beginning to read. His old dear gesture. Subaudible, she said. Not because she completely understood what the word meant, but because it was so clearly what he wanted from her. Precisely, he said, gesturing once more with his ice cream. A splatter of vanilla drops ran up one leg of his khaki pants, and she'd found herself wondering how many beers he'd had already that day. Precisely, sugar. Subaudible. I don't believe in any actual thinking that God marks the fall of every bird in Australia or every bug in India. A God that records all of our sins in a big golden book and judges us when we die. I don't want to believe in a God who would deliberately create bad people and then deliberately send them to roast in a hill he created. But I believe there has to be something. He had looked around the yard with its too high, too patchy grass, the little swing and gym set he had set up for his son and daughter. Pete had outgrown it, and Trisha really had too, although she still swung or would go down the slide a few times when she was here just to please him. The two lawn dwarves, one barely visible in an extravagant splurge of spring weeds, the fence at the very rear that needed painting. In that moment, he had looked old to her, a little confused, a little frightened. A little lost in the woods, she thought now, sitting on the fallen log with her pack between her sneakers. Then he had nodded and looked back at her. Yeah, something. Some kind of insensate force for the good. Insensate. Do you know what that means? She had nodded, not knowing exactly, but not wanting him to stop and explain. She didn't want him to teach her, not today. Today, she wanted only to learn from him. I think there's a force that keeps drunken teenagers, most drunken teenagers, from crashing their cars when they're coming home from a senior prom or their first big rock concert. That keeps most planes from crashing, even when something goes wrong. Not all, just most. Hey, the fact that no one's used a nuclear weapon on actual living people since 1945 suggests there has to be something on our side. Sooner or later, someone will, of course, but over half a century? That's a long time. He had paused, looking out at the lawn dwarves with their vacant, cheery faces. There's something that keeps most of us from dying in our sleep. No perfect love and all-seeing God, I don't think the evidence supports that. But a force. The subaudible? You got it. She had gotten it, but hadn't much liked it. It was too much like getting a letter you thought would be interesting and important. Only when you opened it, it was addressed to Dear Occupant. Do you believe in anything else, Dad? Oh, the usual. Death and taxes, and that you're the most beautiful girl in the world. Dad! She'd laughed and wriggled as he hugged her and kissed the top of her head, liking his touch and his kiss, but not the smell of beer on his breath. He let her go and stood up. I also believe it's beer o'clock. You want some iced tea? No, thanks, she said, and perhaps something prescient had been at work, because as he started away, she said, Do you believe in anything else? Seriously. His smile had faded into a look of seriousness. He stood there thinking. Sitting on the log, she remembered being flattered that he would think so hard on her behalf. His ice cream started to drip over his hand now. Then he had looked up, smiling again. I believe that your heartthrob Tom Gordon can save 40 games this year, he said. I believe that right now he's the best closer in the major leagues, that if he stays healthy and the Sox hit and holds up, he could be pitching in the World Series come October. Is that enough for you? Yes, she had cried, laughing, her own seriousness broken, because Tom Gordon really was her heartthrob, and she loved her father for knowing it and for being sweet about it instead of mean. She had run to him and hugged him hard, getting ice cream on her shirt, not caring. What was a little sunny treat between friends? And now, sitting here in the growing grayness, listening to the drip of water all around her in the woods, watching the trees blur into shapes which would soon become threatening, listening for amplified shouts,
Come to the sound of my voice!
or the distant barking of dogs, she thought, I can't pray to the subaudible. I just can't. She couldn't pray to Tom Gordon either. That would be ludicrous. But perhaps she could listen to him pitch, and against the Yankees at that. WCAS had their socks on. She could put hers on, too. She had to conserve her battery, she knew that, but she could listen for a while, couldn't she? And who could tell? She might hear those amplified voices and barking dogs before the game was over. Tricia opened her pack, reverently removed her Walkman from its inner pocket, and settled the earbuds into place. She hesitated a moment, suddenly sure the radio would no longer work, that some vital wire had been joggled loose in her tumble down the slope, and this time there would be only silence when she pushed the power button. It was a stupid idea, maybe, but on a day when so many things had gone wrong, it seemed like a horribly plausible idea, too. Go on, go on. Don't be chicken guts. She pushed the button, and like a miracle, her head filled with the sound of Jerry Trupiano's voice, and more importantly, with the sounds of Fenway Park. She was sitting out here in the darkening, drippy woods, lost and alone, but she could hear 30,000 people. It was a miracle.
Comes to the belt,
Troop was saying.
He whines, he fires, and strike three called. Martinez caught him looking. Oh, that was a slider, and it was a beaut. That caught the inside corner, and Bernie Williams was just frozen. Oh, my! And at the end of 2.5 innings, it's still the Yankees 2, the Boston Red Sox, nothing.
A singing voice instructed Tricia to call 1-800-54-GIANT for some sort of auto repair, but she didn't hear it. 2.5 innings already played, which meant it had to be 8 o'clock. At first that seemed amazing, and yet given the faded quality of the light, not so hard to believe either. She'd been on her own for 10 hours. It seemed like forever. It also seemed like no time at all. Tricia waved at the bugs. This gesture was now so automatic she didn't even realize she was doing it, and then delved into her lunch bag. The tuna sandwich wasn't as bad as she had feared. Flattened and torn into hunks, but still recognizably a sandwich. The baggie had sort of kept it together. The remaining Twinkie, however, had turned into what Pepsi Robichaux would have liked to have called total splush. Trish sat listening to the game and slowly ate half of her tuna sandwich. It awoke her appetite and she easily could have gobbled the rest, but she put it back in the bag and ate the splushed Twinkie instead, scooping up the moist cake and the nasty, tasty white cream filling. That stuff was always C-R-E-M-E and never C-R-E-A-M, Tricia mused, with one finger. When she had gotten all she could with her finger, she turned the paper inside out and licked it clean. Just call me Mrs. Spratt, she thought, and put the Twinkie paper back into her lunch bag. She allowed herself 3 more big swallows of Surge, then went prospecting for more potato chip crumbs with the tip of one grimy finger as the Red Sox and Yankees played through the rest of the 3rd and 4th. By the middle of the 5th, it was 4-1 Yankees, with Martinez gone in favor of Jim Corsi. Larry McFarland regarded Corsi with deep mistrust. Once, while talking baseball with Tricia over the telephone, he had said, "You mark my words, sugar. Jim Corsi is no friend of the Red Sox." Tricia got giggling. She couldn't help it. It just sounded so solemn. And after a while, Dad had gotten giggling, too. It had become a catchphrase between them, something that was just theirs, like a password. "Mark my words, Jim Corsi is no friend of the Red Sox." Corsi was a friend of the Red Sox in the top of the 6th, though, getting the Yankees 1-2-3. Tricia knew she should turn off the radio and conserve the batteries. Tom Gordon wasn't going to pitch in a game where the Red Sox were 3 runs behind, but she couldn't bear the thought of disconnecting Fenway Park. She listened to the seashell murmur of the voices even more eagerly than to the play-by-play guys, Jerry Trupiano and Joe Castiglione. Those people were there, actually there, eating hot dogs and drinking beer and lining up to buy souvenirs and soft-serve ice cream and chowder from the legal seafood stand. They were watching as Darren Lewis, D-Lou, the announcer sometimes called him, stepped into the batter's box, the bright banks of lights casting his shadow behind him as daytime gave up overhead. She could not bear to exchange those 30,000 murmuring voices for the low hum of mosquitoes, thicker than ever as dusk advanced. The drip of rainwater from the leaves, the rusty rick-rick of the crickets,
and what other sounds there might be. It was the other sounds she was afraid of most. Other sounds in the dark. DeLu singled to right, and one out later, Mo Vaughn got hold of a slider that did not slide.
Back, back, way back,
Troop chanted.
That's in the Red Sox pen. Someone, I think it might have been Rich Garces, caught it on the fly. Home run Mo Vaughn. That's his 12th of the year, and the Yankee lead is cut to one.
Sitting on her tree trunk, Tricia laughed and clapped her hands and then resettled her signed Tom Gordon hat more firmly on her head. It was full dark now. In the bottom of the eighth, Nomar Garcia-Parra hit a two-run shot into the screen on top of the Green Monster. The Red Sox took a 5-4 lead, and Tom Gordon came on to pitch the top of the ninth. Tricia slid off the fallen tree to the ground. The bark scraped against the wasp stings on her hip, but she hardly noticed. Mosquito settled with immediate hungry intent on her bare back where her shirt and the tatters of the blue poncho had rucked up, but she didn't feel them. She gazed at the last held glimmer glow in the brook, fading tarnished quicksilver, and sat on the damp ground with her fingers pressed to the sides of her mouth. Suddenly, it seemed very important that Tom Gordon should preserve the one-run lead, that he should secure this victory against the mighty Yankees, who had lost a pair to Anaheim at the start of the season and had hardly lost since. Come on, Tom, she whispered. In a Castle View hotel room, her mother was in an agony of terror. Her father was on a Delta flight from Boston to Portland to join Quilla and his son. At the Castle County State Police Barracks, which had been designated Rally Point Patricia, search parties very much like the ones the lost girl had imagined were coming back in after their first fruitless sallies. Outside the barracks, news vans from three TV stations in Portland and two in Portsmouth were parked. 36 experienced woodsmen, and some were accompanied by dogs, remained in the forests of Mauton and the three unincorporated townships which stretched off toward New Hampshire's chimney, TR-90, TR-100, and TR-110. The consensus among those remaining in the woods was that Patricia McFarland must still be in Mauton or TR-90. She was a little girl, after all, and likely hadn't wandered far from where she had last been seen. These experienced guides, game wardens, and forest servicemen would have been stunned to know that Tricia had gotten almost 9 miles west of the area the searchers considered their highest priority. Come on, Tom, she whispered. Come on, Tom, 1, 2, 3, now. You know how it goes. But not tonight. Gordon opened the top of the ninth by walking the handsome yet evil Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter, and Tricia remembered something her father had once told her. When a team gets a leadoff walk, their chances of scoring rise by 70%. If we win, if Tom gets the save, I'll be saved. This thought came to her suddenly. It was like a firework bursting in her head. It was stupid, of course, as dopey as her father knocking on wood before a 3-2 pitch, which he did every time. But as the dark grew deeper and the brook gave up its final silver tarnish, it also seemed irrefutable, as obvious as 2 and 2 makes 4. If Tom Gordon got the save, she would get the save. Paul O'Neill popped up. One out. Bernie Williams came up.
Always a dangerous hitter,
Joe Castiglione remarked, and Williams immediately ripped a single to center, sending Jeter to third.
Why did you say that, Joe? Tricia moaned. Ah, cripes. Why did you have to say that?
Runners on first and third, only one out. The Fenway crowd cheering, hoping. Tricia could imagine them leaning forward in their seats.
Come on, Tom, come on, Tom, she whispered.
The clouds of minges and no-see-ums were still all around her, but she no longer noticed. A feeling of despair touched her heart, cool and strong. It was like that hateful voice she discovered in the middle of her head. The Yankees were too good. A base hit would tie it, a long ball would put it out of reach, and the awful, awful Tino Martinez was up, with the most dangerous hitter of all right behind him. The straw man would now be down on one knee in the on-deck circle, swinging a bat and watching. Gordon worked the count on Martinez to 2-2, then threw his curveball.
Struck him out,
Joe Castiglione shouted. It was as if he couldn't believe it.
Aw, man, that was a beauty. Martinez must have missed it by a foot. 2 feet,
Troop added helpfully.
So it all comes to this.
Joe said. And behind his voice, Trisha could hear the volume of the other voices. The fan voices began to rise. The rhythmic clapping started. The Fenway faithful were getting to their feet like a church congregation about to sing a hymn.
Two on, two out. Red Sox clinging to a one-run lead. Tom Gordon on the mound and...
Don't you say it, Trisha whispered, her hand still pressing against the sides of her mouth. Don't you dare say it. But he did.
And the always dangerous Daryl Strawberry coming to the plate.
That was it. Game over. Great Satan Joe Castiglione had opened his mouth and jinxed it. Why couldn't he just have given Strawberry's name? Why did he have to start in with that always dangerous horse pucky when any fool knew that only made them dangerous?
All right, everybody, fasten your seatbelts,
Joe said.
Strawberry cocks the bat. Jeter's dancing around third, trying to draw a throw or at least some attention from Gordon. He gets neither. Gordon looks in. Veritek flashes the sign to the set. Gordon throws. Strawberry swings and misses strike one. Strawberry shakes his head as if he's disgusted. Shouldn't be disgusted. That was a pretty good pitch,
Troop remarked. And Trisha, sitting in the dark, bug-blown armpit of nowhere, thought, Shut up, Troop. Just shut up for a minute.
Straw steps out, taps his cleats. Now he's back in. Gordon, with the look to Williams on first, to the set, he pitches outside and low.
Trisha moaned. The tips of her fingers were now so deeply pressed into her cheeks that her lips were pulled up in a strange, distraught smile. Her heart was hammering in her chest.
Here we go again,
Joe said.
Gordon's ready. He fires. Strawberry swings and... It's a long, high drive to right field. If it stays fair, it's gone, but it's drifting. It's drifting, drifting.
Trisha waited, breath caught.
Foul,
Joe said at last, and she began to breathe again.
But that was too close. Strawberry just missed a three-run homer. It went on the wrong side of the pesky pole by no more than 6 or 8 feet. I'd say 4 feet,
Troop added helpfully. I'd say you've got stinky feet. Come on, Tom, please, Trisha whispered. But he wouldn't. She knew that now for sure. Just this close and no closer. Still, she could see him. Not all tall and ginky looking like Randy Johnson. Not all short and tubby looking like Rich Garces. Medium height, trim, and handsome. Very handsome. Especially with his cap on, shading his eyes. Except her father said almost all ball players were handsome. It comes with the genes, he told her. Then added, Of course, a lot of them have nothing upstairs, so it all balances out. But Tom Gordon's looks weren't the thing. It was the stillness before he pitched, which had first caught her eye and her admiration. He didn't stalk around the mound like some of them did, or bend to fiddle with his shoes, or pick up the rosin bag and then toss it back down in a little flump of white dust. No, number 36 simply waited for the batter to finish all his fiddledy-fiddling. He was still in his bright white uniform, as he waited for the batter to be ready. And then, of course, there was the thing he did whenever he succeeded in getting the save. That thing, as he left the mound. She loved that.
Gordon whines and fires, and it's in the dirt. Veritek blocked it with his body, and that saved the run. The tying run. Stone the crows,
Troop said. Joe didn't even try to dignify that one.
Gordon takes a deep breath out on the mound. Strawberry stands in. Gordon wheels, deals, high.
A storm of booing rose in Trisha's ears like an ill wind.
30,000 or so umps in the stands didn't agree with that one, Joe,
Troop remarked.
True, but Larry Barnett behind the plates got a final say, and Barnett said it was high. The count runs full to Daryl Strawberry, 3-2.
In the background, the rhythmic clapping of the fans swelled. Their voices filled the air, filled her head. She knocked on the wood of the tree trunk without realizing she was doing it.
The crowd's on its feet,
Joe Castiglione said.
All 30,000 of them, because no one has left the joint tonight. Maybe one or two,
Troop said. Trisha took no notice. Neither did Joe.
Gordon to the belt.
Yes, she could see him at the belt, hands together now, no longer facing home plate directly, but looking in over his left shoulder.
Gordon into the motion.
She could see this, too. The left foot coming back toward the planting right foot as the hands, one wearing the glove, one holding the ball, rose to the sternum. She could even see Bernie Williams off with the pitch, streaking for second. But Tom Gordon took no notice, and even in motion his essential stillness remained. His eyes on Jason Veritek's mitt,
hung behind the plate low and toward the outside corner.
Gordon delivers the 3-2 pitch and...
The crowd told her the sudden joyous thunder of the crowd.
Strike 3 called.
Joe was nearly screaming.
Oh my goodness, he threw the curve on 3-2 and froze Strawberry. The Red Sox win 5-4 over the Yankees and Tom Gordon gets his 18th save.
His voice dropped into a more normal register.
Gordon's teammates head for the mound with Mo Vaughn pumping his fist in the air and leading the charge. But before Vaughn gets there, it's Gordon with a quick gesture, the one the fans have gotten to know very well in just the short time he's been the Sox closer.
Trisha burst into tears. She pushed the power button on the Walkman and then just sat there on the damp ground with her back against the tree trunk and her legs spread and the blue poncho hanging between them in its hula skirt tatters. She cried harder than she had since first realizing for sure that she was lost. But this time she cried in relief. She was lost, but would be found. She was sure of it. Tom Gordon had gotten the save, and so would she. Still crying, she took off the poncho, spread it on the ground as far under the fallen tree as she thought she could wriggle, and then eased to her left until she was on the plastic. She did this with very little awareness. Most of her was still at Fenway Park, seeing the umpire ringing Strawberry up, seeing Mo Vaughn starting for the mound to congratulate Tom Gordon. She could see Nomar Garciaparra trotting in from short, John Valentin from third, and Mark Lemke from second to do the same. But before they got to him, Gordon did what he always did when he secured the save. Pointed at the sky. Just one quick point of the finger. Trisha tucked her Walkman back into her pack, but before she put her head down on the outstretched arm, she pointed up briefly, the way Gordon did. And why not? Something had brought her through the day, after all, horrible as it had been. And when you pointed, the something felt like God. You couldn't point to dumb luck or the subaudible, after all. Doing this made her feel better and worse. Better because it felt more like praying than actual words would have done. Worse because it made her feel really lonely for the first time that day. Pointing like Tom Gordon made her feel lost in some heretofore unsuspected fashion. The voices which had poured out of the Walkman's earbuds and filled her head seemed dreamlike now, the voices of ghosts. She shivered at that, not wanting to think about ghosts out here, not in the woods, not cowering under a fallen tree in the dark. She missed her mother. Even more, she wanted her father. Her father would be able to get her out of here, would take her by the hand and lead her out of here. And if she got tired of walking, he would carry her. He had big muscles. When she and Pete stayed weekends with him, he would still pick her up at the end of Saturday night and carry her to her little bedroom in his arms. He did that even though she was 9 and big for her age. It was her favorite part of their weekends in Malden. Trisha discovered, with a miserable species of wonder, that she even missed her boogery, endlessly complaining, brother. Weeping and hitching in big watery gusts of air, Trisha fell asleep. The bugs circled around her in the dark, moving closer and closer. Finally, they began to light on the exposed patches of her skin, feasting on her blood and sweat. A puff of air moved through the woods, ruffling the leaves, shaking the last of the rainwater from them. After a second or two, the air fell still. Then it was not still. In the dripping quiet came the sound of twigs breaking. That stopped, and there was a pause, followed by a flurry of moving branches and a rough, rasping sound. A crow called once, in alarm. There was a pause, and then the sounds began again, moving closer to where Trisha slept with her head on her arm.